A vicious courtroom brawl 2 years earlier against Trelco, with Fitch securing his verdict long before the lawyer stopped arguing. Nussman had not slept Thursday as he plowed through the Glavine jury research. There had been a young white male in Broken Arrow named Perry Hirsch, age 25 at the time, allegedly born in St. Louis on a date which was ultimately determined to be false. He said he worked in a lamp factory and delivered pizzas on the weekend. Single, Catholic, college dropout, no prior jury service, all according to his own words recorded on a brief questionnaire which was given to the lawyers before the trial. He had registered to vote 4 months before the trial and supposedly lived with an aunt in a trailer park. He was one of 200 people who answered the call for jury service. There were two photos of Hirsch. In one, he was hauling a stack of pizzas to his car, a battered Pinto, in a colorful blue and red Rizzo shirt and matching cap. He wore wire-rimmed glasses and a beard. The other was a shot of him standing beside the trailer where he lived, but his face could hardly be seen. Hirsch almost made the Glavine jury, but was cut by the plaintiff for reasons that were unclear at the time. Evidently, he left town at some point after the trial. The factory where he worked employed a man named Terry Hertz, but no Perry Hirsch. Fitch was paying a local investigator to dig furiously. The unnamed aunt had not been found, there were no records from the trailer park, no one at Rizzo's remembered a Perry Hirsch. Fitch and Pang and Nussman sat in the dark and stared at the wall Friday afternoon. The photos of Hirsch, Lancaster, and Easter were blown up and focused as clearly as possible. Easter, of course, was now clean-shaven. His photo was taken as he worked, so there were no sunglasses, no cap. The three faces were of the same person. Nussman's handwriting expert arrived after lunch Friday. He was flown in on a Pinex jet from D.C. He took fewer than 30 minutes to form a few opinions. The only handwriting samples available were the jury information cards from Cimino and Wood and the short questionnaire from Glavine. It was more than enough. The expert had no doubt that Perry Hirsch and David Lancaster were the same person. Easter's handwriting was quite dissimilar from Lancaster's, but he'd made a mistake in running from Hirsch. The carefully printed, block-style hand Easter had used was obviously designed to distinguish itself from earlier trails. He had worked hard to create an entirely new style of writing, one that could not be linked to the past. His mistake came at the bottom of the card when Easter signed his name. The T was crossed low and angled down from left to right, very distinguishable. Hirsch had used a sloppy cursive style, no doubt designed to portray a lack of education. The T in St. Louis, his alleged place of birth, was identical to the T in Easter, though to the untrained eye, nothing about the two appeared remotely similar. He announced without the slightest doubt, "Hirsch and Lancaster are the same people. Hirsch and Easter are the same people. Therefore, Lancaster and Easter must be the same." "All three are the same," Fitch said slowly as it sunk in. "That's correct. And he's very, very bright." The handwriting expert left Cables. Fitch returned to his office, where he met with Pang and Conrad for the rest of Friday afternoon and into the night. He had people on the ground in both Allentown and Broken Arrow digging and bribing and hoping to pry loose employment records and tax withholding forms on Hirsch and Lancaster. "Have you ever known a person to stalk a trial?" Conrad asked. "Never," Fitch growled. The rules for conjugal visits were simple. Between 7 p.m. and 9 p.m. Friday night, each juror could entertain spouses or mates or whomever in their rooms. The guests could come and go at any time, but they first had to be registered by Lou Dell, who sized them up and down as if she and she alone possessed the power to approve what they were about to do. The first to arrive, promptly at 7, was Derek Maples, the handsome boyfriend of young Angel Wheeze. Lou Dell took his name, pointed down the hall, said, "Room 55. He was not seen again until 9, when he came up for air. Nicholas would not have a guest Friday night, neither would Jerry Fernandez. His wife had moved into a separate bedroom a month ago, and she wasn't about to waste her time visiting a man she despised. Besides, Jerry and the poodle were exercising conjugal rights every night. Colonel Herrera's wife was out of town, Lonnie Shaver's wife couldn't find a babysitter, so the four men watched John Wayne in the party room and lamented the sorry states of their romances. Blind old Herman was getting some, but they weren't. Philip Savelle had a guest, but Lou Dell refused to divulge to the rest of the boys the sex, race, age, or anything else about his visitor. It happened to be a very nice young lady who appeared to be Indian or Pakistani. Mrs. Gladys Card watched TV in her room with Mr. Nelson Card. Loreen Duke, who was divorced, visited with her two young teenage daughters. Ricky Coleman exercised conjugal relations with her husband Rhea, then talked about their kids for the remaining 1 hour and 45 minutes. And Hoppy Dupree brought Millie some flowers and a box of chocolates, which she ate most of while he jumped around the room in a fit of excitement, the likes of which she'd rarely seen. The kids were fine, all out on dates, and business was going full speed. In fact, business had never been better. He had a secret, a large, wonderful, rich secret about a deal he'd stepped into, but he couldn't tell her just yet. Maybe Monday, maybe later, but he just couldn't now. He stayed an hour and rushed back to the office for more work. Mr. Nelson Card left at 9, and Gladys made the mistake of stepping into the party room where the boys were drinking beer and eating popcorn and watching boxing matches now. She found a soft drink and sat at the table. Jerry eyed her suspiciously. "You little devil," he said. "Come on, tell us about it." Her mouth fell open and her cheeks flushed. She couldn't speak. "Come on, Gladys, we didn't get any." She grabbed her Coke and jumped to her feet. "Maybe there's a good reason you didn't," she snapped angrily, then marched from the room. Jerry managed a laugh. The other men were too tired and despondent to care. Marley's car was a Lexus, leased from a dealer in Biloxi, a 3-year lease at $600 a month, with the lessee being Rochelle Group, a brand-spanking new corporation Fitch had been able to learn nothing about. A transmitter weighing almost a pound had been attached by a magnet under the rear left tire well, so Marley could now be tracked by Conrad sitting at his desk. Joe Boy had stuck it under there a few hours after they'd followed her from Mobile and seen her license plates. Her large new condo was leased by the same corporation, almost $2,000 a month. Marley had some serious overhead, but Fitch and Company couldn't find a trace of a job. She called late Friday night, just minutes after Fitch had stripped to his XX large boxers and black socks and sprawled on his bed like a beached whale. For now, he owned the presidential suite on the top floor of the Colonial Hotel in Biloxi, on Highway 90, the Gulf 100 yards away. When he bothered to look, he had a nice view of the beach. No one outside his little circle knew where he was. The call went to the front desk, an urgent message for Mr. Fitch, and it posed a dilemma for the night clerk. The hotel was being paid large sums of money to protect the privacy and identity of Mr. Fitch. The clerk could not admit he was a guest. The young lady had it all figured out. When Marley called back 10 minutes later, she was put straight through pursuant to Mr. Fitch's orders. Fitch was now standing with his boxers pulled almost to his chest, but still sagging down past his fleshy thighs, scratching his forehead and wondering how she'd found him. "Good evening," he said.
"Hi, Fitch. Sorry to call so late."
She wasn't sorry about a damned thing. The I in high was deliberately flat, something that happened occasionally with Marley. It was an effort to sound a little southern. The recordings of all 8 phone conversations, however brief, along with a recording of their chat in New Orleans, had been scrutinized by voice and dialect experts in New York. Marley was a Midwesterner from eastern Kansas or western Missouri, probably from somewhere within 100 miles of Kansas City. "No problem," he said, checking the recorder on a narrow folding table near his bed. "How's your friend?"
"Lonely. Tonight was conjugal night, you know."
"So I heard. Did everybody get conjugated?"
"Not exactly. It's pretty sad, really. The men watched John Wayne movies while the women knitted."
"Nobody got laid?"
"Very few. Angel Wheeze, but she's in the middle of a hot romance. Ricky Coleman. Millie Dupree's husband showed up, but didn't stay long. The Cards were together. Can't tell about Herman. And Savelle had a guest."
"What manner of humanity did Savelle attract?"
"Don't know. It was never seen." Fitch lowered his wide rear to the edge of the bed and pinched the bridge of his nose.
"Why didn't you visit your friend?" he asked.
"Who said we're lovers?"
"What are you?"
"Friends. Guess which two jurors are sleeping together."
"Now how would I know that?"
"Guess."
Fitch smiled at himself in the mirror and marveled at his wonderful luck. "Jerry Fernandez and somebody."
"Good guess. Jerry's about to get a divorce, and Sylvia is lonely, too. Their rooms are just across the hall, and, well, there's little else to do at the Siesta Inn."
"Ain't love grand?"
"I gotta tell you, Fitch, Krigler worked for the plaintiff."
"They listened to him, huh?"
"Every word. They listened and they believed. He turned them around, Fitch."
"Tell me some good news."
"Roar's worried."
His spine stiffened noticeably. "What's bugging Roar?" he asked, studying his puzzled face in the mirror. He shouldn't be surprised that she was talking to Roar, so why the hell was he shocked to hear it? He felt betrayed.
"You? He knows you're loose on the street, scheming up all sorts of ways to get to the jury. Wouldn't you be worried, Fitch, if some guy like you was hard at work for the plaintiff?"
"I'd be terrified."
"Roar isn't terrified. He's just worried."
"How often do you talk to him?"
"A lot. He's sweeter than you, Fitch. He's a very pleasant man to talk to. Plus, he doesn't record my calls, doesn't send in goons to follow my car, none of that sort of stuff."
"Really knows how to charm a girl, huh?"
"Yeah. But he's weak where it counts."
"Where's that?"
"In the wallet. He can't match your resources."
"How much of my resources do you want?"
"Later, Fitch. Gotta run. There's a suspicious-looking car sitting across the street. Must be some of your clowns."
She hung up. Fitch showered and tried to sleep. At 2 a.m., he drove himself to the Lucy Luck, where he played blackjack at $500 a hand, sipped Sprite until dawn, when he left with close to $20,000 in fresh winnings.
Chapter 20. The first Saturday in November arrived with temperatures in the low 60s, unseasonably cool for the coast and its near-tropical climate. A gentle breeze from the north rattled trees and scattered leaves on the streets and sidewalks. Fall usually arrived late and lasted until the first of the year, when it yielded to spring. The coast did not experience winter. A few joggers were on the street just after dawn. No one noticed the plain black Chrysler as it pulled into the driveway of a modest brick split level. It was too early for the neighbors to see the two young men in matching dark suits exit the car, walk to the front door, ring the buzzer, and wait patiently. It was too early, but in less than an hour the lawns would be busy with leaf rakers and the sidewalks busy with children. Hoppy had just poured the water into the Mr. Coffee when he heard the buzzer. He tightened the belt of his ragged terry-cloth bathrobe and tried to straighten his unkempt hair with his fingers. Must be the Boy Scouts selling donuts at this ungodly hour. Surely it wasn't the Jehovah's Witnesses again. He'd let them have it this time, nothing but a cult. He moved quickly because the upstairs was filled with comatose teenagers, six at last count, five of his and a guest someone had dragged home from junior college. A typical Friday night at the Dupree home. He opened the front door and met two serious young men, both of whom instantly reached into their pockets and whipped out gold medallions stuck to black leather. In the quick rush of syllables, Hoppy caught FBI at least twice and nearly fainted.
"Are you Mr. Dupree?"
Agent Nitschman asked. Hoppy gasped.
"Yes, but
we'd like to ask you some questions," said Agent Napier as he somehow managed to take a step even closer.
"About what?"
Hoppy asked, his voice dry. He tried to look between them at the street, across it, where Mildred Yancey was no doubt watching all of this. Nitschman and Napier exchanged a harsh, conspiratorial look. Then Napier said to Hoppy, "We can do it here, or perhaps somewhere else."
"Questions about Stillwater Bay, Jimmy Home Moke, things like that,"
Nitschman said for clarification, and Hoppy clutched the door frame.
"Oh, my God!"
he said as the air was sucked from his lungs and most vital organs froze.
"May we come in?"
Napier said. Hoppy lowered his head and rubbed his eyes as if to weep.
No, please, not here.
The children. Normally they'd sleep till 9 or 10, or even noon, for that matter, if Millie let them, but with voices downstairs they'd be up in a minute.
My office, he managed to say.
We'll wait, Napier said.
Make it quick, Nitschmann said.
Thank you,
Hoppy said, and then quickly closed the door and locked it. He fell onto a sofa in the den and stared at the ceiling, which was spinning clockwise. No sounds from upstairs. The kids were still sleeping. His heart pounded fiercely, and for a full minute he thought he might just lie there and die. Death would be welcome now. He could close his eyes and float away, and in a couple of hours the first kid down would see him and call 911. He was 53, and bad hearts ran in his family on his mother's side. Millie would get $100,000 in life insurance. When he realized his heart was determined to continue, he slowly swung to his feet. Still dizzy, he groped his way to the kitchen and poured a cup of coffee. It was 7:05, according to the digital on the oven. 4th day of November, undoubtedly one of the worst days of his life. How could he have been so stupid? He thought about calling Todd Ringwald, and he thought about calling Millard Putt, his lawyer. He decided to wait. He was suddenly in a hurry. He wanted to leave the house before the kids got up, and he wanted those two agents out of his driveway before the neighbors noticed. Besides, Millard Putt did nothing but real estate law, and was not very good at that. This was a criminal matter. A criminal matter. He skipped a shower and dressed in seconds. He was halfway through the brushing of his teeth when he finally looked at himself in the mirror. Betrayal was written all over his face, stamped in his eyes for all to see. He couldn't lie. Deceit was not in him. He was just Hoppy Dupree, an honest man with a fine family, good reputation and all. He'd never cheated on his tax returns. So why, Hoppy, were there two FBI agents waiting outside for a trip downtown? Not to jail yet, though that would surely come, but to a private place where they could eat him for breakfast and lay bare his fraud. He decided not to shave. Perhaps he should call his minister. He brushed his swirling hair and thought of Millie and the public disgrace and the kids and what would everybody think. Before leaving the bathroom, Hoppy vomited. Outside, Napier insisted that he ride with Hoppy. Nitschmann and the black Chrysler followed. Not a word was spoken. Dupree Realty was not the sort of commercial enterprise that attracted early risers. This was true on Saturday as it was for the rest of the week. Hoppy knew the place would be deserted until at least 9, maybe 10. He unlocked doors, turned on lights, said nothing until it was time to ask if they wanted coffee. Both declined and seemed quite anxious to proceed to the slaughter. Hoppy sat on his side of the desk. They huddled together like twins across from him. He was unable to hold their gaze. Nitschmann got it started by saying, "Are you familiar with Stillwater Bay?"
"Yes."
"Have you met a man by the name of Todd Ringwald?"
"Yes."
"Have you signed any type of contract with him?"
"No."
Napier and Nitschmann looked at each other as if they knew this to be false. Napier said smugly, "Look, Mr. Dupree, this will go a lot smoother for you if you tell the truth."
"I swear I'm telling the truth."
"When did you first meet Todd Ringwald?" Nitschmann asked as he pulled a narrow notepad from his pocket and began scribbling.
"Thursday."
"Do you know Jimmy Holmoak?"
"Yes."
"When did you first meet him?"
"Yesterday."
"Where?"
"Right here."
"What was the purpose of the meeting?"
"To discuss the development of Stillwater Bay. I'm supposed to represent a company called KLX Properties. KLX wants to develop Stillwater Bay, which is in Mr. Moak's supervisor's district in Hancock County."
Napier and Nitschmann stared at Hoppy and pondered this for what seemed like an hour. Hoppy silently repeated his words to himself. Had he said something? Something that would speed along his journey to prison? Perhaps he should stop this right now and seek legal counsel. Napier cleared his throat. "We've been investigating Mr. Moak for the past 6 months, and 2 weeks ago he agreed to enter into a plea bargain arrangement whereby he will receive a light sentence in exchange for his assistance." This legal crap speak meant little to Hoppy. He heard it, but things weren't registering clearly right now. "Did you offer money to Mr. Moak?" Napier asked.
No,
Hoppy said, because there was no way he could say yes. He said it quickly, without force or conviction. It just came out.
No,
he said again. He hadn't actually offered money. He had cleared the way for his client to offer money. At least that was his interpretation of what he'd done. Nitschmann slowly reached into his coat pocket, slowly felt around until his fingers were just right, slowly removed a slender pocket something or other, which he slowly placed in the center of the desk.
"Are you sure?"
he asked, almost taunting.
"Sure, I'm sure,"
Hoppy said, staring slack-jawed at the sleek, hideous device. Nitschmann gently pressed a button. Hoppy held his breath and clenched his fists. Then there was his voice, chirping along nervously about local politics and casinos and fishing, with an occasional entry by Moke.
"He was wired,"
Hoppy exclaimed, breathless and totally defeated.
"Yes,"
one of them said gravely. Hoppy could only stare at the recorder.
"Oh, no,"
he mumbled. The words had been uttered and recorded less than 24 hours earlier, right there at that very desk over chicken clubs and iced tea. Jimmy Hull had sat where Nitschmann was and arranged a bribe for $100,000, and he did so with an FBI wire stuck somewhere to his body. The tape dragged painfully on until the damage was done and Hoppy and Jimmy Hull were offering their hurried goodbyes.
"Shall we listen to it again?"
Nitschmann asked as he touched a button.
"No, please,"
Hoppy said, pinching the bridge of his nose.
"Should I talk to a lawyer?"
he asked without looking up.
"Not a bad idea," Napier said sympathetically.
When he finally looked at them, his eyes were red and wet. His lip quivered, but he thrust his chin outward and tried to be bold.
"So, what am I looking at?"
he asked. Napier and Nitschmann relaxed in unison. Napier stood and walked to a bookcase.
"It's hard to say," Nitschmann said, as if the issue would be determined by someone else. "We've busted a dozen supervisors in the past year. The judges are sick of it. The sentences are getting longer."
"I'm not a supervisor,"
Hoppy said.
"Good point. I'd say 3 to 5 years. Federal, not state."
"Conspiracy to bribe a government official," Napier added helpfully. Napier then returned to his seat next to Nitschmann. Both men sat on the edges of their chairs, as if ready to leap across the desk and flog Hoppy for his sins. The mic was the cap of a blue Bic disposable ballpoint sitting harmlessly with a dozen other pencils and cheap pens in a dusty fruit jar on Hoppy's desk. Ringwald had left it there Friday morning when Hoppy had gone to the restroom. The pens and pencils gave the appearance of never being used, the type of collection which would sit untouched for months before being rearranged. In the event Hoppy or someone else decided to use the blue Bic, it was out of ink and would find itself immediately in the wastebasket. Only a technician could disassemble it and discover the bug. From the desk, the words were relayed to a small, powerful transmitter hidden behind the Lysol and air freshener under a restroom vanity next to Hoppy's office. From the transmitter, the words were sent to an unmarked van across the street in a shopping center. In the van, the words were recorded on tape and delivered to Fitch's office. Jimmy Hull had not been wired, was not working with the feds, had in fact been doing what he did best, hustling bribes. Ringwald, Napier, and Nitschmann were all ex-cops who were now private agents employed by an international security firm in Bethesda. It was a firm Fitch used often. The Hoppy sting would cost the fund $80,000. Chicken feed. Hoppy mentioned the possibility of legal counsel again. Napier stonewalled it with a lengthy recitation of the FBI's efforts to stop rampant corruption on the coast. He blamed all ills on the gambling industry. It was imperative to keep Hoppy away from a lawyer. A lawyer would want names and phone numbers, records and paperwork. Napier and Nitschmann had enough fake credentials and quick lies to bluff poor Hoppy, but a good lawyer would force them to disappear. What had begun as a routine probe of Jimmy Hull and graft of the local garden variety had turned into a much broader investigation into gaming and, the magic words, organized crime, according to Napier's lengthy narrative. Hoppy listened when he could. It was difficult, though. His mind raced away with concerns for Millie and the kids and how they would survive for the 3 to 5 years he was gone.
"So we didn't target you," Napier said, wrapping things up.
"And frankly, we'd never heard of KLX Properties," added Nitschmann. "We sort of just stumbled into this."
"Can't you just stumble out?" Hoppy asked, and actually managed a soft, helpless smile.
"Maybe," Napier said deliberately, then glanced at Nitschmann as if they had something even more dramatic to lay on Hoppy.
"Maybe what?" he asked.
They withdrew from the edge of the desk in unison, their timing perfect as if they'd either rehearsed for hours or done this 100 times. They both stared hard at Hoppy, who wilted and looked at the desktop. "We know you're not a crook, Mr. Dupree," Nitschmann said softly.
"You just made a mistake," added Napier.
"You got that right," Hoppy mumbled.
"You're being used by some awfully sophisticated crooks. They roll in here with big plans and big bucks and... well, we see it all the time in drug cases."
"Drugs?"
Hoppy was shocked but said nothing. Another pause as the stares continued.
"Can we offer you a 24-hour deal?" Napier asked.
"How can I say no?
Let's keep this quiet for 24 hours. You don't tell a soul, we don't tell a soul. You keep it from your lawyer, we don't pursue you, not for 24 hours.
"I don't understand.
We can't explain everything right now. We need some time to evaluate your situation."
Nitschmann leaned forward again, elbows on desk.
"There might be a way out for you, Mr. Dupree."
Hoppy was rallying, however faintly.
"I'm listening."
"You're a small, insignificant fish caught in a large net," Napier explained. "You might be expendable."
Sounded good to Hoppy.
"What happens in 24 hours?
"We meet again, right here, 9 o'clock in the morning."
"It's a deal."
"One word to Ringwald, one word to anyone, even your wife, and your future is in serious jeopardy."
"You have my word."
The chartered bus left the Siesta Inn at 10 with all 14 jurors, Mrs. Grimes, Lou Dell and her husband Benton, Willis and his wife Ruby, 5 part-time deputies in plain clothes, Earl Hutto, the sheriff of Harrison County, and his wife Claudel, and 2 assistant clerks from Gloria Lane's office. 28 in all, plus the driver. All approved by Judge Harkin. 2 hours later, they rolled along Canal Street in New Orleans, then exited the bus at the corner of Magazine. Lunch was in a reserved room in the back of an old oyster bar on Decatur in the French Quarter and paid for by the taxpayers of Harrison County. They were allowed to scatter throughout the quarter. They shopped at outdoor markets, strolled with the tourists through Jackson Square, gawked at naked bodies and cheap dives on Bourbon, bought T-shirts and other souvenirs. Some rested on benches along the riverwalk, some ducked into bars and watched football. At 4, they gathered at the river and boarded a paddle-wheeler for a sightseeing trip. At 6, they ate dinner at a pizza and po' boy deli on Canal. By 10, they were locked in their rooms in Pass Christian, tired and ready for sleep. Busy jurors are happy jurors. Chapter 21. With the Hoppy show proceeding flawlessly, Fitch made the decision late Saturday to launch the next assault against the jury. It was a strike made without the advantage of meticulous planning, and it would be as severe as the Hoppy sting was slick. Early Sunday morning, Pang and Dubaz, both dressed in tan shirts with a plumber's logo above the pockets, picked the lock on the door of Easter's apartment. No alarm sounded. Dubaz went straight to the vent above the refrigerator, removed the screen, and yanked out the hidden camera that had caught Doyle earlier. He placed it in a large toolbox he'd brought to remove the goods. Pang went to the computer. He had studied the hurried photos taken by Doyle during the first visit, and he had practiced on an identical unit which had been installed in an office next to Fitch's. He twisted screws and removed the back cover panel of the computer. The hard drive was precisely where he'd been told. In less than a minute, it was out. Pang found 2 stacks of 3.5-inch disks, 16 in all, in a rack by the monitor. While Pang performed the delicate removal of the hard drive, Dubaz opened drawers and quietly turned over the cheap furniture in the search for more disks. The apartment was so small and had so few places to hide anything, his task was easy. He searched the kitchen drawers and cabinets, the closets, the cardboard boxes Easter used to store his socks and underwear. He found nothing. All computer-related paraphernalia were apparently stored near the computer.
"Let's go,"
Pang said, ripping cords from the computer, monitor, and printer. They practically threw the system on the ragged sofa where Dubaz piled on cushions and clothing, then poured charcoal lighter fluid from a plastic jug. When the sofa, chair, computer, cheap rugs, and assorted clothing were sufficiently doused, the two men walked to the door, and Dubaz threw a match. The ignition was rapid and virtually silent, at least to anyone who might have been listening outside. They waited until the flames were lapping the ceiling and black smoke was boiling throughout the apartment, then made a hasty departure, locking the door behind them. Down the stairs on the first level, they pulled a fire alarm. Dubaz ran back upstairs where the smoke was seeping from the apartment and began yelling and beating on doors. Pang did the same on the first level. Screams followed quickly as the hallways filled with panicked people in bathrobes and sweatsuits. The shrill clanging of ancient fire bells added to the hysteria.
"Make damn sure you don't kill anyone," Fitch had warned them.
Dubaz pounded on doors as the smoke thickened. He made certain every apartment near Easter's was empty. He pulled people by the arms, asked if everyone was out, pointed to the exits. As the crowd spilled into the parking lot, Pang and Dubaz separated and slowly retreated. Sirens could be heard. Smoke appeared in the windows of two upstairs apartments, Easter's and one next door. More people scrambled out, some wrapped in blankets and clutching babies and toddlers. They joined the crowd and waited impatiently for the fire trucks. When the firemen arrived, Pang and Dubaz dropped farther back, then vanished. No one died. No one was injured. Four apartments were completely destroyed, 11 severely damaged, nearly 30 families homeless until cleanup and restoration. Easter's hard drive proved impenetrable. He had added so many passwords, secret codes, anti-tampering, and antiviral barriers that Fitch's computer experts were stumped. He'd flown them in Saturday from Washington. They were honest people with no idea where the hard drive and the disks came from. He simply locked them in a room with a system identical to Easter's and told them what he wanted. Most of the disks had similar protections. About halfway through the stack, though, the tension was broken when they were able to evade passwords on an older disk Easter had neglected to adequately secure. The files list showed 16 entries with document names which revealed nothing. Fitch was notified as the first document was being printed. It was a 6-page summary of current news items about the tobacco industry dated October 11, 1994. Stories from Time, The Wall Street Journal, and Forbes were mentioned. The second document was a rambling 2-page narrative describing a documentary Easter had just seen about breast implant litigation. The third was a gawky poem he'd written about rivers. The fourth was another compilation of recent news articles about lung cancer trials. Fitch and Conrad read each page carefully. The writing was clear and straightforward, obviously hurriedly done because the typos were almost cumbersome. He wrote like an unbiased reporter. It was impossible to determine whether Easter was sympathetic to smokers or just keenly interested in mass tort litigation. There were more dreadful poems, an aborted short story, and finally, pay dirt. Document number 15 was a 2-page letter to his mother, a Mrs. Pamela Blanchard in Gardner, Texas. Dated April 20, 1995, it began, "Dear Mom, I'm now living in Biloxi, Mississippi on the Gulf Coast," and proceeded to explain how much he loved salt water and beaches and could never again live in farm country. He apologized at length for not writing sooner, apologized for two long paragraphs about his tendency to drift, and promised to do better with his letter writing. He asked about Alex, said he hadn't talked to him in 3 months and couldn't believe he'd finally made it to Alaska and found a job as a fishing guide. Alex appeared to be a brother. There was no mention of a father, no mention of a girl, certainly not anyone named Marley. He said he'd found a job working in a casino, and it was fun for the moment, but not much of a future. He still thought about being a lawyer and was sorry about law school, but he doubted he'd ever go back. He confessed to being happy, living simply, with little money and even fewer responsibilities. Oh well, gotta run now, lots of love, say hello to Aunt Sammy, and he'd call soon. He signed off simply as Jeff. Love, Jeff. No last name appeared anywhere in the letter. Dante and Joe Boy left on a private jet an hour after the letter was first read. Fitch instructed them to go to Gardner and hire every private snoop in town. The computer people cracked one more disk, the next to the last of the bunch. Again, they were able to sidestep the anti-tampering barriers with a complicated series of password clues. They were very impressed by Easter's hacking ability. The disk was filled with part of one document, the voter registration rolls of Harrison County. Starting with A and running through K, they printed over 16,000 names with addresses. Fitch checked on them periodically throughout the printing. He, too, had a complete printout of all registered voters in the county. It was not a secret list. In fact, it could be purchased from Gloria Lane for $35. Most political candidates made the purchase during election years. But two things were odd about Easter's list. First, it was on a computer disk, which meant he had somehow managed to enter Gloria Lane's computer and steal the information. Second, what did a part-time computer hack part-time student need with such a list? If Easter accessed the clerk's computer, then he certainly could tamper with it enough to have his own name entered as a prospective juror in the Wood case. The more Fitch thought about it, the more it made perfect sense. Hoppy's eyes were red and puffy as he drank thick coffee at his desk early Sunday and waited for 9 a.m. He hadn't eaten a bite since a banana Saturday morning while the Folgers brewed in his kitchen just minutes before the doorbell rang and Napier and Nitschman entered his life. His gastrointestinal system was shot. His nerves were ragged. He'd sneaked too much vodka Saturday night, and he'd done it at the house, something Millie prohibited. The kids had slept through it all Saturday. He hadn't told a soul, hadn't been tempted to, really. The humiliation helped keep the loathsome secret safe. At precisely 9, Napier and Nitschman entered with a third man, an older man who also wore a severe dark suit and severe facial expressions as if he'd come to personally whip and flay poor Hoppy. Nitschman introduced him as George Cristano from Washington, Department of Justice. Cristano's handshake was cold. He didn't make small talk. "Say, Hoppy, would you mind if we had this little chat somewhere else?" Napier asked as he looked scornfully around the office. "It's just safer," Nitschman added for clarification. "You never know where bugs might show up," Cristano said. "Tell me about it," Hoppy said, but no one caught the humor. Was he in a position to say no to anything? "Sure," he said. They left in a spotless black Lincoln town car, Nitschman and Napier in the front, Hoppy in the back with Cristano, who matter-of-factly began to explain that he was some type of high-ranking assistant attorney general from deep inside justice. The closer they got to the Gulf, the more odious his position became. Then he was silent. "Are you a Democrat or a Republican, Hoppy?" Cristano asked softly during one particularly long lull in the conversation. Napier turned at the shore and headed west along the coast. Hoppy surely didn't want to offend anyone.
"Oh, I don't know. Always vote for the man, you know. I don't get hung up on parties, know what I mean?"
Cristano looked away out the window as if this wasn't what he wanted. "I was hoping you were a good Republican," he said, still looking through the window at the sea. Hoppy could be any damn thing these boys wanted, absolutely anything. A card-carrying, wild-eyed, fanatical communist, if it would please Mr. Cristano.
"Voted for Reagan and Bush," he said proudly, "and Nixon, even Goldwater."
Cristano nodded ever so slightly, and Hoppy managed to exhale. The car became silent again. Napier parked it at a dock near Bay St. Louis, 40 minutes from Biloxi. Hoppy followed Cristano down a pier and onto a deserted 60-foot charter boat named Afternoon Delight. Nitschman and Napier waited by the car, out of sight. "Sit down, Hoppy," Cristano said, pointing to a foam-padded bench on the deck. Hoppy sat. The boat rocked ever so slightly. The water was still. Cristano sat across from him and leaned forward so that their heads were 3 feet apart.
"Nice boat,"
Hoppy said, rubbing the imitation leather seat.
It's not ours. Listen, Hoppy, you're not wired, are you?
Instinctively, he bolted upright, shocked by the suggestion. Of course not!
Sorry, but these things do happen. I guess I should frisk you.
Costano looked him up and down, quickly.
Hoppy was horrified at the thought of being fondled by this stranger alone on a boat.
I swear I'm not wired, okay? Hoppy said, so firmly that he was proud of himself.
Cristano's face relaxed.
You want to frisk me? He asked.
Hoppy glanced around to see if anyone was within view. Looks sort of odd, wouldn't it? Two grown men rubbing each other in broad daylight on an anchored boat.
Are you wired? Hoppy asked.
No.
Swear?
I swear.
Good.
Hoppy was relieved and quite anxious to believe the man. The alternative was simply unthinkable.
Cristano smiled, then abruptly frowned. He leaned in. The small talk was over.
I'll be brief, Hoppy. We have a deal for you. A deal which will enable you to walk away from this without a scratch. Nothing. No arrest, no indictment, no trial, no prison, no face in the newspaper. In fact, Hoppy, no one will ever know.
He paused to catch his breath, and Hoppy charged in.
So far, so good. I'm listening.
It's a bizarre deal, one we've never attempted. Has nothing to do with law and justice and punishment, nothing like that.
It's a political deal, Hoppy.
Purely political. There'll be no record of it in Washington. No one will ever know except for me, you, those two guys waiting by the car, and less than 10 people deep inside justice. We cut the deal, you do your part, and everything is forgotten.
You got it. Just point me in the right direction.
Are you concerned about crime, drugs, law and order, Hoppy?
Of course.
Are you sick of graft and corruption?
Odd question. At this very moment, Hoppy felt like the poster child for the campaign against corruption.
Yes.
There are good guys and bad guys in Washington, Hoppy. There are those of us at Justice who've devoted our lives to fighting crime. I mean serious crime, Hoppy. I mean drug payoffs to judges and congressmen who take money from foreign enemies. Criminal activity that could threaten our democracy. Know what I mean?
If Hoppy didn't know for sure, then he certainly was sympathetic to Cristano and his fine friends in Washington.
Yes, yes, he said, hanging on every word.
But everything's political these days, Hoppy. We're constantly fighting with Congress and we're fighting with the President. Do you know what we need in Washington, Hoppy?
Whatever it was, Hoppy wanted them to have it. Cristano didn't give him the chance to answer.
We need more Republicans. More good conservative Republicans who'll give us money and get out of our way. The Democrats are always meddling, always threatening budget cuts, restructuring, always concerned about the rights of these poor criminals we're picking on. There's a war raging up there, Hoppy. We fight it every day.
He looked at Hoppy as if he should say something, but Hoppy was momentarily trying to adjust to the war. He nodded gravely, then looked at his feet.
We have to protect our friends, Hoppy. And this is where you come in.
Okay.
Again, this is a strange deal. Take it and our tape of you bribing Mr. Moak will be destroyed.
I'll take the deal. Just tell me what it is.
Cristano paused and looked up and down the pier. Some fishermen were making noises far away. He leaned closer and actually touched Hoppy on the knee.
It's about your wife, he said, almost under his breath, then reared back to let it sink in.
My wife?
Yes, your wife.
Millie?
That's her.
What the hell?
I'll explain.
Millie?
Hoppy was flabbergasted. What could sweet Millie have to do with a mess like this?
It's the trial, Hoppy, Cristano said, and the first piece of the puzzle plunged roughly into place. Guess who contributes the most money to Republican congressional candidates?
Hoppy was too stunned and confused to offer an intelligent guess.
That's right. The tobacco companies. They pour millions into races because they're afraid of the FDA and they're fed up with government regulations. They're free enterprise people, Hoppy, same as you. They believe people smoke because they choose to smoke, and they're sick of the government and the trial lawyers trying to run them out of business.
It is political,
Hoppy said, staring at the gulf in disbelief. Nothing but politics. If Big Tobacco loses this trial, then there will be an avalanche of litigation the likes of which this country has never seen. The companies will lose billions, and we'll lose millions in Washington. Can you help us, Hoppy? Jolted back to reality, Hoppy could only manage...
Say what?
Can you help us?
Sure, I guess. But how?
Millie, you talk to your wife. Make sure she understands how senseless and how dangerous this case is. She needs to take charge in that jury room, Hoppy. She needs to stand her ground against those liberals on the jury who might want to bring back a big verdict. Can you do it?
Of course I can.
But will you, Hoppy? We don't want to use the tape, okay? You help us and the tape goes down the toilet. Hoppy suddenly remembered the tape.
Yeah, you got a deal. I'll see her tonight, as a matter of fact.
Go to work on her. It's terribly important. Important for us, at justice, for the good of the country. And, of course, it'll keep you out of prison for 5 years. Cristano delivered the last line with a hoarse laugh and a slap on the knee. Hoppy laughed, too. They talked about strategy for half an hour. The longer they sat on the boat, the more questions Hoppy had. What if Millie voted with the tobacco company, but the rest of the jury disagreed and delivered a big verdict? What would happen to Hoppy then? Cristano promised to hold his end of the deal regardless of the verdict as long as Millie voted right. Hoppy virtually skipped along the pier as they returned to the car. He was a new man when he saw Napier and Nitschmann. After deliberating on his decision for 3 days, Judge Harkin reversed himself late Saturday and decided the jurors would not be permitted to attend their churches Sunday. He was convinced all 14 would suddenly possess an amazing desire to commune with the Holy Spirit, and the idea of them fanning out to all parts of the county was simply unworkable. He called his minister, who in turn made more calls, and a young divinity student was located. A chapel service was planned for 11 o'clock Sunday morning in the party room at the Siesta Inn. Judge Harkin sent a personal note to each juror. The notes were slid under their doors before they returned from New Orleans Saturday night. 6 people attended the service, a rather dull affair. Mrs. Gladys Card was there in a surprisingly nasty mood for the Sabbath. She hadn't missed Sunday school at the Calvary Baptist Church in 16 years, the last absence caused by the death of her sister in Baton Rouge. 16 straight years without a miss. She had the perfect attendance pins lined up on her dresser. Esther Knobloch in the Women's Mission Union had 22 years, the current record at Calvary, but she was 79 and was afflicted with high blood pressure. Gladys was 63, in fine health, and thus considered Esther catchable. She couldn't admit this to anyone, but everyone at Calvary suspected it. But now she'd blown it, thanks to Judge Harkin, a man she didn't like from the start and now despised. And she didn't like the divinity student either. Ricky Coleman came in a jogging suit. Millie Dupree brought her Bible. Loreen Duke was a devout churchgoer, but was appalled at the brevity of the service. On at 11 and over by 11:30, typical hurried style of white folks. She'd heard of such foolishness, but had never worshipped in such a manner. Her pastor never got to the pulpit before 1, and often didn't leave it until 3 when they broke for lunch, which they ate on the grounds if the weather was nice, then trooped back inside for another dose. She nibbled on a sweet roll and suffered in silence. Mr. and Mrs. Herman Grimes attended, not through any calling of faith, but because the walls in room 58 were closing in. Herman, in particular, had not voluntarily gone to church since childhood. Throughout the course of the morning, it had come to be known that Philip Savelle was angered at the notion of worship. He told someone he was an atheist, and this news had spread in a flash. To protest, he positioned himself on his bed, apparently nude, or certainly close to it, folded and tucked his wiry legs and arms into some type of yoga drill, and hollered chants at full volume. He did this with the door open. He could be heard faintly in the party room during the service, and this no doubt was a factor in the young divinity student's rather hastened wrap-up and benediction.
Lou Dell marched down the first time to tell Savell to shut up, but backed away quickly when she noticed Savell's nakedness. Willis tried next, but Savell kept his eyes closed and his mouth open and simply ignored the deputy. Willis kept his distance. The non-worshipping jurors hunkered down behind locked doors and watched loud televisions. At 2, the first relatives began to arrive with fresh clothing and supplies for the week. Nicholas Easter was the only juror with no close contact on the outside. It was determined by Judge Harkin that Willis would drive Easter in a squad car to his apartment. The fire had been out for several hours. The trucks and firemen were long gone. The narrow front lawn and sidewalk in front of the building were strewn with charred debris and piles of soggy clothing. Neighbors milled about, stunned but busily going about the cleanup.
"Which one's yours?" Willis asked as he stopped the car and gaped at the burnt crater in the center of the building.
"Up there," Nicholas said, trying to point and nod at the same time. His knees were weak as he left the car and walked to the first cluster of people, a family of Vietnamese who were mutely studying a melted plastic table lamp.
"When did this happen?" he asked.
The air was thick with the acrid smell of freshly burnt wood and paint and carpet. They said nothing.
"This morning, about 8, answered a woman as she walked by with a heavy cardboard box.
Nicholas looked at the people and realized he didn't know a single name. In the small foyer, a busy lady with a clipboard was scribbling notes while talking on a cell phone. The main staircase to the second level was guarded by a private security guard who at the moment was helping an elderly woman drag a wet throw rug down the steps.
"Do you live here?"
the woman asked when she finished her conversation.
"Yes, Easter in 312.
"Wow, totally destroyed. That's probably where it started."
"I'd like to see it."
The security guard led Nicholas and the woman up the steps to the second floor, where the damage was quite apparent. They stopped at a yellow caution tape at the edge of the crater. The fire had gone upward through the plaster ceilings and cheap rafters and had managed to burn 2 large holes in the roof, directly over the spot where his bedroom used to be, as far as he could tell. And it had burned downward, severely damaging the apartment directly under him. Nothing was left of number 312 except for the kitchen wall, where the sink hung by one end and seemed ready to fall. Nothing. No sign of the cheap furniture in the den, no sign of the den itself. Nothing from the bedroom except blackened walls. And, to his horror, no computer. Virtually all the floors, ceilings, and walls of the apartment had vanished, leaving nothing but a gaping hole.
"Anybody hurt?" Nicholas asked softly.
"No." "Were you home?" she asked.
"No."
"Who are you?"
"I'm with the management company.
I have some forms for you to fill out."
They returned to the foyer, where Nicholas hurriedly did the paperwork and left with Willis.
Chapter 22. It was pointed out to Judge Harkin by Philip Savell in a tersely worded, hardly legible message that the word conjugal, as defined by Webster, covered husband and wife only, and he objected to the term. He did not have a wife and had little regard for the institution of marriage. He suggested communal interludes, and he went on to bitch about the worship service held that morning. He faxed the letter to Harkin, who received it at home during the fourth quarter of the Saints game. Lou Dell arranged the fax through the front desk. 20 minutes later, she received a return fax from His Honor changing the word conjugal to personal and relabeling the whole thing personal visits. He directed her to make copies for all jurors. Because it was Sunday, he threw in another hour from 6 p.m. to 10 instead of 9. He then called her to ask what else Mr. Savell might want and inquired as to the general mood of his jury. Lou Dell just couldn't tell him about seeing Mr. Savell all nude and perched on his bed like that. She figured the judge had enough things to worry about. Everything was fine, she assured him. Hoppy was the first guest to arrive, and Lou Dell whisked him away quickly to Millie's room, where he once again delivered chocolates and a small bouquet of flowers. They kissed briefly on the cheeks, never considered anything conjugal, and lounged on the beds during 60 minutes. Hoppy slowly brought the conversation around to the trial, where he struggled to keep it for a while.
"Just doesn't make sense, you know, for people to sue like this. I mean, it's silly, really. Everybody knows cigarettes are addictive and dangerous, so why smoke? Remember Boyd Dogan? Smoked Salem's for 25 years, quit just like that, he said, snapping his fingers.
Yeah, he quit 5 minutes after the doctor found that tumor on his tongue, Millie reminded him, then added a mocking snap of her own.
Yeah, but lots of people quit smoking. It's mind over matter. Not right to keep smoking, then sue for millions when the damn things kill you.
Hoppy, your language.
Sorry.
Hoppy asked about the other jurors and their reactions so far to the plaintiff's case. Mr. Cristano thought it would be best to try and win Millie over with the merits, instead of terrorizing her with the truth. They'd talked about this over lunch. Hoppy felt treacherous, plotting against his own wife, but each time the guilt hit him, so did the thought of 5 years in prison. Nicholas left his room during halftime of the Sunday night game. The hall was empty of jurors and guards. Voices were heard in the party room, generally male voices, it seemed. Once again, the men drank beer and watched football while the women made the most of their personal visits and communal interludes. He slid silently through the double glass doors at the end of the hallway, ducked around the corner past the soft drink machines, then bounded up the stairs to the second floor. Marley was waiting in a room she'd paid cash for and registered under the name of Elsa Broom, one of her many aliases. They went straight to bed, with a minimum of words and preliminaries. Both had agreed that 8 consecutive nights apart was not only a record for them, but also unhealthy. Marley met Nicholas, when both had other names. The point of contact was a bar in Lawrence, Kansas, where she worked as a waitress and he spent late nights with pals from law school. She had collected 2 degrees by the time she settled in Lawrence, and because she wasn't eager to initiate a career, she was pondering the option of law school, that great American babysitter for directionless post-grads. She was in no hurry. Her mother had died a few years before she met Nicholas, and Marley had inherited almost $200,000. She served drinks because the hangout was cool and she would have been bored otherwise. It kept her in shape. She drove an old Jaguar, watched her money closely, and dated only law students. They noticed each other long before they spoke. He'd come in late with a small group, the usual faces, sit in a booth in a corner, and debate abstract and incredibly boring legal theories. She'd deliver draft beer in pitchers and try to flirt, with varying degrees of success. During his first year, he was enamored with the law and paid little attention to girls. She asked around and learned he was a good student, top 3rd in his class, but nothing outstanding. He survived the first year and returned for the second. She cut her hair and lost 10 pounds, though it wasn't necessary. He had finished college and applied to 30 law schools. 11 said yes, though none were top 10. He flipped a coin and drove to Lawrence, a place he'd never seen. He found a 2-room apartment stuck to the rear of a spinster's crumbling house. He studied hard and had little time for a social life, at least during the first 2 semesters. The summer after his first year, he clerked for a large firm in Kansas City, where he pushed inter-office mail from floor to floor with a cart. The firm had 300 lawyers under one roof, and at times it seemed as though all were working on one trial, the defense of Smith Greer in a tobacco lung cancer case down in Joplin. The trial lasted 5 weeks and ended with a defense verdict. Afterward, the firm threw a party and 1,000 people showed up. Rumor was that the catered celebration cost Smith Greer $80,000. Who cared? The summer was a miserable experience. He hated the big firm, and midway through his second year, he was fed up with the law in general. No way he would spend 5 years locked in a cubbyhole writing and rewriting the same briefs so rich corporate clients could be bilked. Their first date was to a law school keg party after a football game. The music was loud, the beer plentiful, the pot passed around like candy. They left early because he didn't like noise and she didn't like the smell of cannabis. They rented videos and cooked spaghetti in her apartment, a rather spacious and well-furnished layout. He slept on the sofa. A month later, he moved in and first broached the subject of dropping out of law school. She was thinking about applying. As the romance blossomed, his interest in things academic diminished to the point of barely completing his fall exams. They were madly in love,
and nothing else mattered. Plus, she had the benefit of a little cash, so the pressure was off. They spent Christmas in Jamaica between semesters of his second and final year. By the time he quit, she'd been in Lawrence for 3 years and was ready to move on. He would follow her anywhere. Marley had been able to learn little about the fire Sunday afternoon. They suspected Fitch, but couldn't pinpoint a reason. The only asset of value was the computer, and Nicholas was certain no one could breach its security system. The important disks were locked away in a vault in Marley's condo. What could Fitch gain by burning a run-down apartment? Intimidation, maybe, but it didn't fit. Fire officials were conducting a routine investigation. Arson seemed unlikely. They'd slept in finer places than the Siesta Inn, and they'd slept in worse. In 4 years, they'd lived in 4 towns, traveled to a half dozen countries, seen most of North America, backpacked in Alaska and Mexico, rafted the Colorado twice, and floated the Amazon once. They had also tracked tobacco litigation, and that journey had forced them to set up housekeeping in places such as Broken Arrow, Allentown, and now Biloxi. Together, they knew more about nicotine levels, carcinogens, statistical probabilities of lung cancer, jury selection, trial tactics, and rank and Fitch than any group of high-powered experts. After an hour under the covers, a light came on beside the bed, and Nicholas emerged, hair ruffled, reaching for clothing. Marley got dressed and peeked through the shades at the parking lot. Directly below them, Hoppy was trying his best to discount the scandalous revelations of Lawrence Krigler, testimony Millie seemed quite impressed with. She dished it out to Hoppy in heavy doses and was puzzled by his desire to argue so much. Just for the fun of it, Marley had left her car parked on the street a half a block from the offices of Wendell Rohr. She and Nicholas were operating under the assumption that Fitch was following every move she made. It was amusing to imagine Fitch squirming with the idea that she was in there, in Rohr's office, actually meeting with him face to face and agreeing to who knew what. For the personal visit, she had arrived in a rental car, one of several she'd used in the past month. Nicholas was suddenly weary of the room, an exact replica of the one he was confined to. They went for a long drive along the coast. She drove, he sipped beer. They walked down a pier above the gulf and kissed as the water rocked gently below them. They talked little of the trial. At 10:30, Marley emerged from the car at a point 2 blocks from Rohr's office. As she walked hurriedly along the sidewalk, Nicholas followed nearby. Her car was parked alone. Joe Boy saw her get into it and radioed Conrad. After she drove away, Nicholas hurried back to the motel in the rental car. Rohr was in the midst of a heated council meeting, the daily gathering of the 8 trial lawyers who'd put up $1 million each. The issue Sunday night was the number of witnesses left to be called by the plaintiff, and as usual, there were 8 separate opinions about what to do next. 2 schools of thought, but 8 very firm and very different inclinations about precisely what would be effective. Including the 3 days spent selecting the jury, the trial was now 3 weeks old. Tomorrow would start week 4, and the plaintiff had enough experts and other witnesses to go on for at least 2 more weeks. Cable had his own army of experts, though typically the defense in these cases used less than half the time of the plaintiff. 6 weeks was a reasonable prediction, which meant the jury would be sequestered for almost 4 weeks, a scenario that troubled everyone. At some point, the jury would rebel, and since the plaintiff used the bulk of the court time, the plaintiff had the most to lose. But on the other hand, since the defense went last and the jury would tire at the end, then perhaps the jury's venom would be aimed at Cable and Pinex. This argument raged for an hour. Wood v. Pinex was unique, because it was the first tobacco trial featuring a sequestered jury. It was, in fact, the first sequestered civil jury in the history of the state. Rohr was of the opinion that the jury had heard enough. He wanted to call only 2 more witnesses, finish their case by noon Tuesday, then rest and wait for Cable. He was joined by Scotty Mangrum of Dallas and Andre Durand of New Orleans. Jonathan Kotlak of San Diego wanted 3 more witnesses. The opposing view was vigorously pushed by John Riley Milton of Denver and Rainer Lovelady of Savannah.
Since they'd spent so damned much money on the world's greatest collection of experts, why be in a hurry, they argued. There remained some crucial testimony from outstanding witnesses. The jury wasn't going anywhere. Sure, they'd get tired, but didn't every jury? It was far safer to stick to the game plan and try the case thoroughly than to jump ship in midstream because a few jurors were getting bored. Carney Morrison of Boston harped repeatedly on the weekly summaries from the jury consultants. This jury was not convinced. Under Mississippi law, it would take 9 of the 12 to get a verdict. Morrison was certain they didn't have 9. Rohr especially paid little attention to the current analyses of how Jerry Fernandez rubbed his eyes and how Loreen Duke shifted her weight and how poor old Herman twisted at the neck when Dr. So-and-so was testifying. Frankly, Rohr was sick of the jury experts, and especially sick of the obscene sums of money they were getting. It was one thing to have their assistance while investigating potential jurors. It was a far different matter to have them lurking everywhere during the trial, always anxious to prepare a daily report to tell the lawyers how the case was trying. Rohr could read a jury far better than any consultant. Arnold Levine of Miami said little, because the group knew his feelings. He'd once taken on General Motors in a trial that lasted 11 months, so 6 weeks was a warm-up for him. There was no coin toss when the vote was even. It had been agreed long before jury selection that this was Wendell Rohr's trial, filed in his hometown, fought in his courtroom before his judge and his jurors. The plaintiff's trial counsel was a Democratic body to a point, but Rohr had veto power, which could not be overridden. He made his decision late Sunday, and the serious egos left bruised but not permanently damaged. There was too much at stake for bickering and second-guessing. Chapter 23. The first order of business Monday morning was a private meeting between Judge Harkin and Nicholas, the topic being the fire and his well-being. They met alone in chambers. Nicholas assured him he was fine and had enough clothing at the motel to wash and rewash. He was just a student with little to lose, with the exception of a fine computer and some expensive surveillance equipment, all of which was, of course, uninsured along with everything else. The fire was dispensed with quickly, and since they were alone, Harkin asked, "So how are the rest of our friends doing?" Chatting off the record like this with a juror was not improper, but was certainly in the gray area of trial procedure. The better practice was to have the lawyers present and to record every word with a court reporter. But Harkin wanted just a few minutes of gossip. He could trust this kid. "Everything's fine," Nicholas said.
"Nothing unusual?"
"Not that I can think of."
"Is the case being discussed?"
"No. In fact, when we're together, we try to avoid it."
"Good. Any spats or squabbles?"
"Not yet."
"Food's okay?"
"Food's fine."
"Enough personal visit?"
"I think so. I haven't heard any complaints." Harkin would have loved to know if there was any hanky-panky among the jurors, not that it would carry any legal significance. He just had a dirty mind.
"Good. Let me know if there's a problem, and let's keep this quiet."
"Sure," Nicholas said. They shook hands, and he left. Harkin greeted the jurors warmly and welcomed them back for another week. They seemed eager to get to work and finish this ordeal. Rohr rose and called Leon Robilio as the next witness, and the players settled down to business. Leon was led from a side door into the courtroom. He shuffled gingerly in front of the bench to the witness stand where the deputy assisted him in having a seat. He was old and pale, dressed in a dark suit, white shirt, no tie. He had a hole in his throat, an opening covered by a thin white dressing and camouflaged with a white linen neckerchief. When he swore to tell the truth, he did so by holding a pencil-like mic to his neck. The words were the flat, pitchless monotone of a throat cancer victim without a larynx. But the words were audible and understandable. Mr. Robilio held the microphone close to his throat, and his voice rattled around the courtroom. This was how he talked, dammit, and he did so every day of his life. He meant to be understood. Rohr got quickly to the point. Mr. Robilio was 64 years old, a cancer survivor who'd lost his voice box 8 years earlier and had learned to talk through his esophagus. He had smoked heavily for nearly 40 years, and his habits had almost killed him.
Now, in addition to the after effects of the cancer, he suffered from heart disease and emphysema, all because of the cigarettes. His listeners quickly adjusted to his amplified, robot-like voice. He grabbed their attention for good when he told them he'd made his living for 2 decades as a lobbyist for the tobacco industry. He quit the job when he got cancer and realized that even with the disease, he couldn't stop smoking. He was addicted, physically and psychologically addicted to the nicotine in cigarettes. For 2 years after his larynx was removed and the chemotherapy ravaged his body, he continued to smoke. He finally quit after a near-fatal heart attack. Though obviously in bad health, he still worked full-time in Washington, but now he